Welcome to Session 5 of PDH Course E281, the audio version of Practical Plant Energy Reduction. We just looked at a picture, and I tried to read it to you if you weren't looking at the drawing, of connecting a logger to a circuit breaker to measure the current. Now, that works on circuit breakers because the largest wire... Oh, actually, I think I've seen some parallel cables connected to circuit breakers, which get a little too big for a clamp on. And that's the problem. What happens when you need more than 600 amps and you've got bigger wires than you can get the clamp on around? Well, there's another gadget that's about the same, but obviously a little bit bigger. I'm using a brand name, Flex Core, because I can't remember the generic name. And that's such a wonderful description. In the clamp on current logger, it's got little fixed jaws. Look a little bit like a scissors, but not much like a scissors. Maybe more like a pair of pliers, but with a big opening, and they open and close. Well, the Flex Core has the same idea, except it's got a big round thing, and they're available in 10 inches and 12 inches and 18 inches. I mean, big round things. And they pull apart, you slip it around the wire, and you push them together, and they have a light cable going out to the logger. And again, the Flex Core current logger. Flex Core is a brand name for the transducer. It is not the current logger. You can buy current loggers including them, or you can buy the Flex Core device to go into an existing logger. And there's a real cute gadget that is a Flex Core on one end and something like a Flex Core on the other end. And what you do is you clamp on your old clamp on to the one end, and then the one end, the other end that opens up and goes around the bus bars or the multi-conductor cables goes on the other end, and it gives you a 10 to 1 or a 20 to 1 ratio, and it's probably a whole heck of a lot more than that, isn't it? But in any event, you look in the catalog if you want one of these things, and FlexCore is a brand which is highly recommended. It's really good stuff. I would guess they've got the majority of the market, but a lot of people make this device, and it is flexible. It isn't just a circle that opens up. You can bend it in, let's say, square shapes to go around bus bars. It'll go around a 2,000 amp bus bar real nice. Okay, so we've got this thing, and it's got the Flex Core that you put around the output of the circuit breaker, and it's got a little umbilical cable that goes back to the current logger, and it's got a start and stop button on the logger. I mean, it's real straightforward. And KWH equals voltage line to line times current line to line times the square root of 3 times 0.8 for power factor. Now, I want to talk about a real tricky subject now, so please pay attention. If you're listening in the car and you're coming up to an intersection, pause the tape for a few minutes till you know you're in a straightaway and you can pay attention. What do you do with high voltage? Most chillers run at high voltage. It's very rare to see a 600 amp chiller. I'm sorry, 600 volt chiller, 480 volt chiller. When they're at 480 volts, they're usually part of an air conditioning unit rather than a chilled water system where they just chill down the water and circulate the water around, then blow fans across coils with the water running through. A chiller system is how you distribute cold water. Well, they're medium voltage, 4,000 volts, 4160, very, very common, 12.8, 13.5, medium voltage, very, very common. So what do? Well, you stick your clamp on in there, and you come back a week later, and you take it out. Really and truly, general purpose instruments work fine on medium voltage. Now, why is that? Well, don't put it around the bus bar. You stay away from those medium voltage bus bars. But insulated medium voltage cables have the same magnetic field that insulated 600 volt cables have. The clamp on works great, whether it's a Flex Core clamp on or open jaws meter kind of clamp on. Now, the scary part of this, and the part I want you to pay attention is, you really, really don't want to go inside a medium voltage switchgear cabinet. Now, we talked about this before, and I gave you some choice on how to save money on the project when you're working on 600 volt cabinets like motor control centers and I-line power distribution cabinet. These are well designed devices. They're set up to make it safe for electricians, And electricians include very good electricians and not so good electricians. And the stuff is designed to make it safe for the not so good electricians. I'm not going to say it's foolproof, and I don't mean that at all, but it's well designed. You have to go to some trouble to hurt yourself on it. Medium voltage isn't like that. It takes much less of a mistake to have a very, very unfortunate incident. And my recommendation, my personal recommendation, is hire somebody to do the medium voltage. The hazard is so high there, you don't want it on you, and you don't want it on your firm. Now, again, you have to use your judgment and your experience and that of the people that are working with you. If you should be working with the maintenance manager on this. And if he's got a guy that does real good work on medium voltage, you listen to the guy that does good work on medium voltage. Don't work too hard telling him how to do things on medium voltage, because there's a lot of hazard there. The flexible clamp-on is large enough to go around bus bars. Installation of a power factor meter. Well, what is power factor? I don't think I'm going to answer that. It's a very difficult thing to explain. Let me just say that both high-intensity discharge lighting, fluorescent metal halide, mercury vapor, and motors have a magnetic component that requires current. It has to come from someplace. They don't work without magnetic current. Now, what's the difference between real current and magnetic current? Not going to tell you that. I'm just going to tell you, you pay for real current, and you have to come up with the magnetizing current somewhere. Now, how do you measure how much of your current is magnetizing current? You measure it with a power factor meter. Power factor meter says power factor. You're at 100%. All of the amps are power amps. They are real amps. But you never get 100% power factor. You always get 90% or 80%, meaning there's 20% that is necessary to make the lighting work and to make the motors work, but they don't produce product. You don't get foot candles out of the magnetizing current in a light. You don't get shaft horsepower out of the magnetizing current on a motor. Now, also, you don't pay for it. It comes free from the utility, and that's not quite true, but it's kind of true. It's free from the utility, except the magnetizing current is the same current we were talking about that causes voltage drops. Well, voltage drops reduce the available energy at your motor. Voltage drop is actual watts. That is a lost energy that you're using. So what we would like to do is create this magnetizing current as close as possible to the user of the magnetizing current. So if you choose, you can buy capacitors that provide magnetizing current right at the motor. This is very common on large machines, like 100 horsepower motor. Very common to have a box of capacitors next to it that provide the magnetizing current. The magnetizing current does not come down to the wire for the starter, does not go through the transformer to supply the starter. So we have saved something by putting in these capacitors. Now, we're going to get into some more discussion of this, but I wanted to tell you what magnetizing current is and what power factor is. Power factor is how much real you got compared to the total amps. And if it's 100%, it's all real. If it's 90%, there's 10% of magnetizing current there that you have to supply capacity for and does produce heat, but you're getting no value from it. If you've got 80% power factor, you're providing 20% magnetizing current. Anything below 80% is really bad and requires some capacitors right away. But we talk about 80% as the nominal value. We talk about 90% as a target value. How do you measure power factor? Now, if you've noticed, I've been a little tricky dancing around the edge of what power factor is, what magnetizing current is. Power factor is what you measure with a power factor meter. Can we all agree on that? How do you hook up a power factor meter? Well, you got to put a clamp on to find out what the amps are, and you've got to tell the meter what the volts are, because Power factor is the relationship between the volts and the amps. If it's exactly the same, that's the 1.0 we're talking about. But if the volts and the amps are different, that's where we're measuring the magnetizing current. So we got a picture here of a clamp on that goes around the phase conductor to give you the amps, and we've got a couple probes going to phase A and the ground, because I'm using line to neutral ground, not line to neutral voltage for phase measurements. Now we can get into high-powered electrical engineering, but trust me, the ideas of single phase and three phase have a real close relationship. If you do things right for single phase, you're doing the same thing right for three phase. So we measure the amps on three phase, check one of them, that tells you what's going on in the other two. If we check the power factor on one of the phases pretending it's single phase, that's the power factor on the three phase circuit. Installation of an electric power factor meter. Follow NITA and OSHA guidelines and meter manufacturer's instructions for installation. FlexCore adapters are available to increase the range of digital clamp-on meters. Now, let me step back and restate something I've said several times, and I hope I'm communicating effectively. It's dangerous to work inside energized cabinets. When you clip around an insulated conductor, you're pretty safe. Stay away from the copper lugs. That's where it'll knock you down. Unfortunately, to get the voltages, you have to connect to the copper lugs. And this is another case where I don't do power factor measurements. Never. An electrician does power factor measurements. They have special skills, they have special training, they go through a lot of safety preparation, they have special personal protective equipment. I will do clamp-ons myself, even though I don't recommend it, but I will not do phase measurements and I will not enter medium voltage gear. Natural gas, shown back on the plant energy balance diagram, is the sum of all natural gas utility service points. Natural gas is a little different than electricity in that in-plant high-pressure distribution is more common and a single delivery point is practical. Nonetheless, it's common to have a plant made up of multiple buildings, each with separate natural gas delivery and main meter. The drill-down supplemental screens identify utility meters, main taps, and departments served. Water usage is addressed as important but put off until later stage of the project and not addressed by this course. The reason for the inclusion in the diagram is that energy reduction is only a first step in environmental responsibility. Water usage reduction is expected to be a future mandate. Boxed item, zero water discharge plants are presently in service. Now, if you're not familiar with this concept, that's mind-blowing. You know, we're talking about massive plants. We're not talking about little backyard shops. I worked on building a zero-discharge General Motors facility in Mexico, and it was zero discharge. They had wells that brought in a very limited amount of water. I mean, it was in the desert, and there wasn't a lot of water available, and they were sharing this with the town nearby. And they discharged nothing. Now, if this is a mind-blowing concept, I've got some references in the written version of this, the PDF version of this, where you can go to the internet and read about this. But places like it was metal plating, if you're familiar with industry, one of the nastiest industries that exists, all kinds of toxic in use, and they become contaminated, and what do you do with them? Well, we always used to dump them. We either find someplace legal or illegal to dump them. But today, you refine your waste stream and put it back in service, and you have a very concentrated toxic that you've got to get rid of. You may have to pay to haul it off, but it's still a zero discharge plant because you're not dumping it into the sewer. Sunlight is the sum of radiant heat gain from the sun, which must be managed by HVAC equipment. By recognizing this energy stream in the top-level summary, groundwork is laid for modified roof coloring and insulation. It's appropriately part of an energy balance as sunlight is a heat input, which moves to cooling water and waste heat discharges of the plant. And we got off the beam a while back and talked quite a bit about insulation of the roof. So I think this does mean something. And obviously, there's a difference between a plant in Maine and a plant in Arizona in the sunlight that's hitting it and the appropriate roofing materials. Raw material. The energy state of the raw material used by the production process may be significant. In the steel industry, incoming and intermediate products are alternately heated and cooled in the forming and property control stages. Annealing, you know, grain orientation. If I think of while, I can come up with a lot of words on this. They're always heating and cooling stuff. And quenching. God, how they love quenching in the steel industry. Well, these are heat sources and heat sinks. And if the right person looks at the process, he should be able to find ways to reduce the amount of electricity you buy for the alternate heating and cooling and still be able to do the forming necessary and still be able to do the properties control that's necessary. Trucks on the interstate highway carrying ingots may benefit by the plant energy usage, benefit the plant energy usage measure by insulation or enhanced cooling. I say this because I drive into Cleveland, Ohio, and I see these plants with the trucks with the steaming ingots on the back of them. I say, now is that good for the industry or bad for the industry? Another thing I wonder about is the scale on them. I don't know enough about steel, certainly about steel process, to answer these questions. But if today's question is energy usage, let's look where the energy usage is and see what we can do to get free energy rather than paying for the energy. Tower flume. Wet cooling towers suck in outside air and blow it through sprays of plant cooling water to bring the plant water down to a temperature approaching the outside air temperature. Discharge air is called tower flume and contains droplets of plant water and heavy concentration of minerals and treatment chemicals. The magnitude of the discharge heat is a measure of the loss that can be eliminated to reduce energy usage. Radiated heat. Dry cooling towers are called by many names, including fin fans. Most of the places I've worked, they're called fin fans, but there's a generic name, which I don't remember right now, so I'm going to call them fin fans, too. The term fin fan describes the operation. Plant cooling water, or any process fluid, is pumped through a heat exchanger with fins like a car radiator. Outside air is blown across the fins to take away the heat. Rejected heat is called radiated heat here. And again, it's a loss. We're paying for this heat. We're paying to get it out of the plant. If we could find a way to reduce the amount that we're putting in, we're ahead. If we can reuse instead of discharging the heat, we're coming out ahead. Exhaust air. The normal standard for in-plant ambient air is human comfort. In winter, heat may be added to keep it above 60F and wear a long-sleeve shirt. In summer, high CFM exhaust or mechanical cooling may be used to keep it below 80F. Fans, heating air, cooling air cost money. Now, I mean the fans, too. It says here a little later. I just worked on a plant that had kind of a big production area, and in each of the four corners, they had a 100-horsepower fan that blew air down, and in the summer, they blew outside air down. In the winter, they circulated air and picked the hot air near the ceiling and blew it down. But these were 100-horsepower fans. Well, 100-horsepower fans use a fair amount of electricity, and if you can figure out what's going on and figure out how to get the effect and turn the fans off or reduce the variable speed drive and run them at a lower energy level, those are bucks of energy reduction. That's our objective here. Fans, heating air, and cooling air cost money, and the condition of the exhaust air is an indication of the losses involved. To follow the energy balance flows, we need to include exhaust air. Plant exhaust air fans may be 20 to 100 horsepower in continuous duty. Any reduction or elimination shows up as a substantial energy reduction. Now, if you were paying close attention, you noticed I was talking about downflow fans, and then the text here is talking about exhaust air fans. Anytime you got a big motor, you've got an energy usage, and you've got to ask the question, what value are we getting from this? Could we get the same value at a lesser cost by the same method with an adjusted device or by a different device entirely? And that leads into the next one. This doesn't show up on the diagram at all. It was something I thought of while I was typing the list. But direct-fired comfort heaters provide an opportunity for energy savings. These are not construction site salamanders, but components of sophisticated HVAC systems. Now, what does direct-fired heater mean? It means you are using the flue gas in the space. You are not exhausting the flue gas and running through a heat exchanger, because you only get a fraction of the heat when you run it through a heat exchanger. If you can convince people to breathe the flue gas, you're getting 100% of the heat generated. Now, is this legal? Well, that's why we got mechanical engineers. They are legal. I've installed them. I've worked in plants that have them. That's going to be 5 years ago now, but I worked on a major renovation of a huge plant, and they put in direct-fired heaters in the process areas. Not for process heating, but for comfort heating. So it's something worth discussing, and discuss it with a guy who knows what he's talking about. I mean, I say Johnson Controls because I know him very well. There are a lot of people out that put together package systems. They buy somebody's fan, they buy somebody's heater and FM approved burner train, and they do sheet metal around them. Well, I'm not saying the guy who fabricates it knows everything that's going on, but the engineer who specifies it certainly does. And I met a lot of extremely competent HVAC engineers, normally called mechanical engineers, who can talk intelligently on this subject and tell you what's available as savings, and if there are untoward effects, safety and such. Typically, you put in a monitor and you shut the thing down when it's going sour on you. You don't poison people and say, hey, I'm saving money, I'm poisoning people. You shut it down and get service on it when it's not working right. That doesn't mean we can't afford savings. It means we have to be careful to get our savings. Flue gas is a common term for stack discharges from a fired steam plant. Extensive studies have been made to minimize the waste components of flue gas. Modern home furnaces are termed 98% efficient because the flue gas is just slightly above 70F. Modern home furnaces condense acid from the flue gas that was formerly handled by the high temperatures and convection in the chimney. The same problems apply to flue gas energy recovery in the industrial setting. We'll talk a little more about this later. Cooling water is the normal label for internal plants pipes carrying process water used for cooling purposes. This is an important measure of waste heat rejected by the process, which of course corresponds to heat input. A second meaning for cooling water is heat rejected into a river or tributary. It has the added incentive for control because of increasing EPA regulation. A major opportunity of reduction of purchased energy is reuse of formerly rejected heat. Wastewater. Wastewater ranges in class. Boiler blowdown is especially concentrated chemically treated water. The contained chemicals and dissolved solids are damaging to equipment and to the environment. Most cooling water listed separately is non-potable, that is non-drinkable, but not hazardous, appropriate for irrigation with some restrictions. Chemical waste mixed with plant water can be very toxic, but see the zero discharge web references above. Now let me put in an aside here. Going to be, 15 years ago, I worked on renovation of a building. It had been a retail place. I mean, I think it was like 9, 10, 11 stories. I mean, pretty big downtown department store. And it was being converted to be a community college. A real nice project. I mean, everything about it was a nice project. The engineers on the project put a row of packaged boilers in the penthouse, with the elevator control equipment and all that. And they were nice packaged boilers, and I'd put in packaged boilers before. I was owner's agent on that. I wasn't part of the construction team or the design, but real nice installation. With one exception that bothered me when I first saw it and bothers me every time I think of it since. They put tempering water in the blowdown stream. Whoa, what's going on here? Well, in a boiler, you increase the concentration every time it loops through the system. That's just the nature of boiler systems. The boiler water, what's called feed water, becomes more and more concentrated in solids. The way you handle this is you blow it down. You open a valve and let it go down the drain. Now, if you recapture the heat from this, I say you are a good boy. If you dump 300 degree water down the drain, you are a bad boy. If you dump 300 degree water down the drain and you're worried about melding the PVC drain piping, so you run city water down at the same time, you are a very naughty boy. And that's what they chose to do. They didn't invest any money in heat recovery on the blowdown. Now, the reason this is so appalling to me is, remember the idea, energy balance, what goes in one end goes out the other end? If you decide to open a valve to discharge things, you've got to make it up. Well, that's the way it is on a boiler. If you're blowing down, you must make up simultaneously. So every time you open the blowdown valve, you're opening the add water valve. If you just loop the discharge piping around the incoming piping, you transfer a major component of that heat from the blowdown stream to the makeup stream. So this idea of tempering the water as it goes down the drain so you don't melt the drain, it's just abhorrent. I mean, it is such a brazen violation of good judgment. And I never got to talk to the guy that designed that. Wish I had. Okay, I have talked way too much about wastewater. Let's take a break here and come back and talk about solid waste.